In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was without form and empty. And darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, I want you to hold that thought in your mind for a second, because before we get to it, I want to actually tell you another story. And I want to see how many of you know the story that I'm telling. So I'm going to sort of play out a typical line in this story. You tell me if you know what I'm talking about. I am so thrilled that Victor Newman and Nikki are back together. I mean, I know they've been married and divorced about 4 or 5 times now, but I just feel like they're right for one another. But I tell you what, I don't trust that Jack Abbott as far as I can throw him. He's a scoundrel. I'm pretty convinced he's going to take over Jabot Cosmetics again. I just don't like him. Now, part of me is thinking too many of you know what story I'm talking about. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Oh, the shame, the shame, the shame that's coming. This is, of course, from The Young and the Restless, the soap opera. Yeah. Oh, that's embarrassing. But there are some of you that have no idea what I was talking about there, right? You were completely unfamiliar with that story, which would be a problem if I said this morning's topic is this, the place of capitalism, patriarchy, and power within the fictional world of Genoa City. You'd be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. That would be a very confusing topic because you don't know that story. Well, most of you don't. Some of you do. And so it will be hard to follow, right? Well, here's the thing. We encounter a similar problem in Genesis 1. Not that you don't know The Young and the Restless, but that there's a story many of us don't know. And because of that, Genesis 1 looks and feels very different to us than it would to an ancient audience. Again, Genesis opens this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was without form and empty. Darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, many people today believe this story is about God creating something out of nothing. But if you were living in Old Testament times, you would have known that there's actually a prequel to this story. There's a backstory. You would know that this story is actually commentary on another story. And the odd thing is this, this story is so well known to the Old Testament audience that it's buried and only like alluded to in Scripture. You like find hints of it here and there. But it appears this, that at some point before this story, God battled against some kind of dragon monster, sometimes called Leviathan or Rahab, and you're thinking, possibly, what? I don't remember that in Sunday school. Well, take a look at a few verses from the Old Testament here, and pay attention, there's always a setup, follow the water, if you will. Listen to what Psalm 74 says. My God is my king from long ago. He brings salvation on the earth. It was you who split open the sea by your power. You broke the heads of the monster in the waters. It was you who crushed the heads of Leviathan and gave it as food to creatures of the desert. Now, whatever the psalmist is talking about here, I'm not familiar with that story. Psalm 89. Who is like you, Lord God Almighty? You rule over the surging sea. When its waves mount up, you still them. You crushed Rahab like one of the slain. Now again, I'm familiar with the story of Rahab and the spies. I'm not familiar with Rahab the sea monster. No idea what's going on here. Isaiah 51. Awake, awake, arm of the Lord, clothe yourself with strength. Awake as in days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a good road in the depths of the sea? Another Rahab that God apparently cut up, and a monster God pierced. What is going on? This is odd. And you know, for so much of my life, when I would come across stuff like this in the Old Testament, I would just be like, gee, Old Testament's so weird. Anyway, and just move on. But what these passages are alluding to is a story so well known to biblical audiences that it didn't need to be told in the pages of Scripture because everyone knew it. But it's a story that few of us have heard. And this is the story. In the beginning, God defeated a chaos monster. But where would a story like that come from? Well, I've come to think, in fact, I'm quite confident. The book of Genesis, I think, was actually written either during Israel's exile or more probably after their exile. As they were turning from Babylon back to Israel, it was written in that period. And I think this is important because it frames the story well. From the time of the exile of Israel forward, everyone would have been familiar with Babylon's creation story. And you see, in the ancient world, the gods did not create something out of nothing. No, the way the world looks is because the gods tamed chaos. And so the story in Genesis begins not with nothing, but like all other creation stories, it begins with chaos. We're given the portrait in Genesis 1 here of a chaotic and formless void. Water was seen as the place of chaos. In the Hebrew, the word to describe this is tohu wabohu. And it means a place that is formless and empty, but bursting with potential. And so the story is this, tohu wabohu, a chaos filled with endless, deep potential. And that's the portrait that we're given in the first few verses of Genesis. And it sets itself up as this, a retelling, an alternative telling, of the Babylon story of the Enema Elish. And in that story, the deep, the chaos, the waters were filled with endless, deep potential, personified in the goddess Tiamat. And so to start, Genesis is a response to the trauma Israel experienced in Babylon. They had been taken over, dragged from their homes to Babylon in captivity, and they would have heard this story over and over and over and over again in Babylon. And so they come home and they write their own creation story. It's a counter story to Babylon's story. It shares the exact same assumptions and storyline as the Babylonian story, but with some marked differences. So the Babylon creation story, Enema Elish, it's like a mythical soap opera. The god, Marduk, he's the patron god of the city-state Babylon. He has a long-standing grievance with his great-grandmother, the goddess Tiamat. Got to get this right in my head. Now, apparently, this divine family needed some counseling. There was a lot of conflict, but they didn't, and so they decided to fight it out. And so the story is actually very sophisticated, but it plays out like a Jerry Springer episode. And so in the Enema Elish, it explains how the god Marduk brought about order out of chaos that Tiamat was causing. And the story plays out this way. Tiamat is seen as a personification of salt water, ocean, chaos, and she births a gang of 11 monsters. This is what it says. Tiamat gave birth to monster snakes, fierce dragons, serpents, dragons, hairy hero men. I like that one. Lion monsters, lion men, scorpion men, mighty demons, fish men, bull men, 11 on the Y she created. This crew begins to be referred to as the Maleficent 11, which I think would be a great rock band, right? I'd like to start a band, the Maleficent 11. And they are, with Tiamat, the monsters of chaos. And so before the battle, the world is chaotic, it's out of order. And Marduk steps up to do battle with Tiamat and her crew. And he throws a net over Tiamat. He hurls a zephyr through her open mouth. She then inflates like a balloon. So Marduk shoots an arrow into her belly, slaying her dead. Seeing this, the crew of 11, they try to run, but Marduk captures them. And then, to make the world a place of order instead of chaos, Marduk cuts Tiamat in half, you know, as you do. Actually, he fillets her from top to bottom, and uses her body parts to bring order to cosmic chaos. So he uses half of her body to make a barrier that separates water from dry land, the parallels in Genesis. Genesis is called the firmament. The waters of chaos are kept in place by Marduk's body. Now, the problem is Marduk doesn't kill her crew of 11 monsters. Simply locks them up, which is key to the story. What makes it very sophisticated. They're locked up, but not dead. Are you following the story? Okay, you're with me. Let me illustrate it this way. When I was 16, my neighbors, they decided for a very odd reason to hire me throughout the summer to take care of their kids. I was the babysitter. And so every day from 7 till 3 p.m., I had to take care of these boys. And I was 16, so I was always staying up late, and I would show up at 7, and the mom was always like, okay, you can let them watch one half hour of TV, then make sure they play. And every day I would go, I'd fall asleep on the couch, and I'd wake up at 10, and I'm like, oh, shoot, they're still watching TV. Like, I was the worst babysitter ever. Every day for lunch, it was like, here's a wiener. I was horrible. But the one day, one of their favorite games they liked to play was Big Bad Wolf. And so I would play with them. I would be the Big Bad Wolf. And we would wrestle, pillow fights. And the one day, they're like, we're locking you up, Big Bad Wolf. I said, okay. So they took me. And they had this really small dog kennel. And they put me in the dog kennel, and they locked it up. And I'm like, let me out, you know. And then, you know, after half an hour, I'm like, all right, game over. So I reach my fingers out to unlock the thing, and the one boy grabs a hockey stick and whap, ah. He's like, jeepers, creepers. He's like, you stay in. I'm like, ah. And then the two of them were banging on it with their hockey sticks. I'm like, good Lord, what have I gotten in myself? They started through the thing. I couldn't reach. They were poking me with their sticks back there. I'm like, guys, this is getting serious. Let me out. Stay in there. Oh, I eventually got out. I'm here, right? But this is that, in short, it was what's going on. Marduk hasn't killed the crew of 11. He's locked them up. But the key with these monsters is they're always trying to get out. And what the story suggests is this, and it's echoed in Genesis. A healthy world consists not of no chaos, but of checked chaos. Chaos subdued. Chaos is the raw energy of the world. And so to kill off chaos entirely, it would eliminate the possibility of change and conflict, and no good story comes about without conflict. So the 11 are then put on leashes at Marduk's feet, and as long as they remain on their leash, the world consists of raw energy and order in balance. But the trouble is, because there's always trouble, occasionally they get off their leash. And when that happens, look out. Now you might think, this is a crazy story. What a weird myth. But think about this. Every story you have ever watched or read about monsters follows this exact same plot line. From Godzilla to Frankenstein to most of the horror movies you have seen, they all follow this plot line. Consider Jurassic Park. I don't know if you would call that a horror movie proper, but it scared me. First Jurassic Park movie, what is the story about? We've created monsters, but they're caged. And what happens is they get out of their cage and start causing chaos. And the whole storyline is, how do we get chaos subdued again? Every horror movie follows this line. In fact, it's also the premise of simple and fun children's stories like The Cat in the Hat. Right? This kid's story, it's profound. Because the mother says to them, don't let anyone in the house. What do? The cat comes knocking. They let the cat in, and then the cat lets out thing one and thing two. And what happens? It's complete chaos in the house. And then they spend the rest of their time going, oh my goodness, we have to clean up. We have to cage thing one and thing two. In so many good stories, what happens is some kind of monster of chaos busts out of its cage, turns the world into a chaotic mess. And the story that follows is always some hero trying to get the monster back into its cage so that order is restored. And this is why the story of Genesis 1 is beyond mythical, it's archetypal. They're not just myths, these stories. They speak to the way the world works, how order and chaos interact with each other. And think about it. Right now, all of us are concerned about what? I would guess this. We're all concerned that the monster of nuclear weapons might get out of its cage. We haven't had to worry about this since the 80s. But right now, we're worried, right? Don't let that monster out of its cage. Because if we do, trouble is coming. And this is the backstory to Genesis. The story Genesis is retelling is this story with some important twists. John Levinson writes this, the confinement of chaos rather than its elimination is the essence of creation. And so you could say this. In the creation story, God subdues chaos, but just barely. What I mean by that, the problem is, again, monsters get off their leashes. Remember when I was a paper boy, 8 years old, every day, neither rain nor hail nor sleet, I was out there delivering papers. And I'm pretty sure it was 29 Adam Street. That address sticks out to me. They had this dog. It was a Rottweiler. And there was a big gravel driveway, and it was always on a leash. And its leash extended right up to the mailbox. So when I was coming with the paper, it would just growl and hiss and run at me, and then, you know, stuck on its leash and just snapped the whole time. And I'd put the newspaper in and on my way. But I'll never forget the day, because it was the first day that I remember being terrified. I came around the corner, and I saw the dog standing in the driveway, and its leash was not on. I remember thinking, oh God, here we go. And it was like this stare down. I'm like, just be calm. And slowly I pulled out a paper and started to roll it up, because I knew a battle was coming. And then, poof, it took off after me. And I'm 8. So, and I'm hitting the dog, and I'm screaming, help, help. And it's nipping at me, and I had to wait until some neighbor came out, grabbed the dog, brought it back, put it on its leash. That right there is the story of the world. Monsters on leashes, they get off, and the question becomes, what do you do? How do you contain it again? All of life is sort of experienced that way. Like how Timothy Beale says it, in the ancient world, as in the modern monster tale, it is difficult to keep a good monster down. They have a tendency to reawaken, reassemble their dismembered parts, and return for a sequel. Or as Gregory Mobley says, creation in Genesis 1 is not about making things out of nothing. It's about bringing definition and identity and differentiation to the amorphous chaos, the tohu wabohu, the wild and waste. But the cosmic waters are not obliterated. They're fenced in, says later. As the tale of Noah and the flood makes clear, the sky dome can spring leaks and the chaotic waters can return. Love that. You could say the rest of the Old Testament, the rest of Scripture is about when chaos gets off its leash, getting it back on. And here's the thing. If you use that lens to understand the rest of Genesis, a lot of things start to illuminate really quickly. The flood story, I can't wait. We're getting there in November or something, I think. I can't wait. It's a return of the chaos story. But I think it's fair to say much of the Old Testament is about caging chaos. And so the Genesis story is the same story as the Babylonian one, except this. It argues Yahweh is the real chaos tamer, and it highlights key differences between the way Yahweh contains chaos and how other would-be gods do that. So, how does God contain chaos? First, where there is the chaos of no form, God will make habitable, ordered space. And then second, where there is emptiness, God will fill it. And if you read through Genesis 1, the whole chapter, it follows this precise pattern. Day 1 to 3, create the space. Day 4 to 6, fill in the space. Whole chapter is structured as an answer to the formless void of chaos problem. Now, of course, everything comes back to Seinfeld. So, 30-second clip. If you want to understand what Genesis 1 is about, it's this. It'll work without the sound. Let's go back. There you go.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Come in.
Where can I put this?
What is it?
It's Risk, Jerry. The game of world conquest. All right, that's perfect.
Kramer, why do you have to...
Hello, Newman.
That's Genesis. Clear the table, set up the game. You know, one of these years I want to do a whole season where there has to be a Seinfeld reference in every sermon. That would be great fun, right? No? That's it. Create space, fill it. If you want to play a game at home and your table is cluttered, you clear it off, then you set up the game. This is exactly what's happening in Genesis 1. Day 1 to 3, clear off the table. Day 4 to 6, set up the game. And it's right there. You can track it. Day 1, God makes room for light, creates space for the sun, moon, and stars. Day 2, God makes room, creates space for the birds and sea creatures, anything that technically doesn't need land. Day 3, God moves the oceans aside to make space for dry land. Then days 4 to 6, God fills the space created. And it's a counter story to the story of Marduk and Tiamat. And you see, the uniqueness of Israel's God in the ancient mindset is not that God created something out of nothing, but in how God tames chaos. And it's in these differences that these stories become archetypal, speak very powerfully to us. I mean, consider one of the biggest differences in the story. Marduk contains chaos through violence and battle. Yahweh tames chaos without violence through spoken word. Man, I think that's powerful. You know, there are a lot of complicated issues going on in the world right now. I do not want to oversimplify them. But this story speaks powerfully. Before we get past verse 2, it's speaking directly to our world. Let me ask you this. How do you contain the chaos of white supremacy and the surge of neo-Nazism? It's a question that we're all facing right now. Through violence or through words? I was on Facebook the other week, and Facebook has become so complicated to me, I'm scared to comment on people's posts. But a friend of mine had posted a comic saying, make sure you protect your hands when you punch Nazis in the face. Here's how you protect your hand when you punch Nazis. I thought, no. That's not how you deal with the chaos of white supremacy. It isn't. It only breeds more chaos. God's word speaks powerfully here. Chaos is tamed not through violence. Well, how do you contain the chaos of Kim Jong-un and the threat of a nuclear North Korea? Is it through fire and fury and total destruction? No. Millions of people dead is not an acceptable way to contain chaos. In fact, it just unleashes more of it. And I know these are complicated issues. I don't want to sound too trite, but the question of Genesis 1 is an important question for all of us. How do we contain chaos? How do we keep it on its leash? How do we participate in bringing order to chaos? I think this chapter offers such a profound vision of first steps towards that. Let me offer another answer this chapter provides. You see, fundamental to how we see the world as Christians in particular is Genesis 1 offers a breathtaking assessment of humanity. At the apex of the creation story, God is filling the order of space, and it culminates in this. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea, and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. This is a staggering idea. In the history of the world, it's a staggering idea. In the Babylonian creation stories, humans were an afterthought. They were created as almost slaves to do the things the gods were too lazy to do or just didn't want to do. This is remarkable, the elevation of humans as a whole, male and female, to the level of divine image bearer. This idea is at the very roots of our entire culture. And you know, there's some, I encounter them all the time, who'd say, we don't need these stories. They are primitive. We have evolved beyond this. And all I can say is this, man, look out. Be very careful what you wish for. Because the notion that every single human being, regardless of their peculiarities and their strangeness, their sins, their crimes, their quirks, their weirdness, that all of us have something divine in us, that needs to be regarded with respect and sanctity. And I find it very difficult to believe anyone other than God could have come up with this idea. This summer, there's so much talk about human rights these days, I decided I was going to actually read through all of the documents listing human rights, like read right through them. So I went through the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the U.S. Bill of Rights, the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights. And I got to the U.S. Declaration of Independence, and it has a very peculiar line in it. It says this: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And that statement struck me as just wrong. Like, what? Not the content, but the idea that this is self-evident. The idea that humans are created equal, that is not a self-evident truth to me, not at all. And it clearly wasn't to the people who wrote it, because they wrote it while owning slaves and excluding women. They wrote it and missed it themselves. I mean, I think we take this idea for granted that humans, all humans, are worthy of dignity because we carry the divine stamp within us, and we lose this idea at our peril. The moment we lose this idea, the monsters are off their leash. You would think the history of the 20th century would remind us of that, but it's happening everywhere today. Here's what I do think is self-evident: that the various differences between people are so obvious and so evident that you could say the natural or self-evident way of viewing human beings is extremely hierarchical. For many of us, some people, mostly those outside of my tribe or ideological bounds, are contemptible, ignorant, easily brushed off as having little to no value at all. So this statement in Genesis, it floors me. And I don't think it's self-evident that all of us have some transcendent value about us. I mean, that is revolutionary, and we're in chapter 1. We dispel with the idea at our serious peril. When we lose this, all hell breaks loose, and I see it happening everywhere these days. We just don't truly believe people have the stamp of the divine in them. And so if we ask ourselves the question, how do we participate in bringing order to chaos? I think it's this: we must endlessly remind ourselves, we must remind each other in this community, we must remind the world of this astounding idea. We are all made in the image of God. Keep it front and center. Whether it's the addict on the street, the person who is other to you, the person who is ugly to you, the person who is foreign to you, the person who is despicable to you, opposite of you, we all bear the image of the divine. And to remember that, and to work to remember that, is to keep chaos at bay. It's a remarkable thing. Do you know how beautiful you are? That we're humming, each of us, we're humming with the divine. Every single person in this room, it's remarkable. For me, it can only be revelation. I can't comprehend how anyone would arrive at this, how that would be self-evident 10,000 years ago. How else do we participate with God in containing chaos and bringing about order? Well, I like to think of it this way. Look around you, in front of you, within you. Look at your actual sphere of influence, but start small. This is what I'm trying to do anyway. Start fixing the small things that announce themselves as in need of repair in order. Here's the thing that I'm convinced. I think all of us want to change the world, right? But few of us have the patience to change the really small things. Name out loud today 5 things you could do tonight or tomorrow morning that would allow you to live into the raw, chaotic energy and potential inside of you. Because I think it's so important for us to learn how to distinguish between chaos and order, be able to act on it in a way that produces order. Start here, start like this. I think it's a great question. I've been asking myself this. Where do you feel chaos in your own life? Where do you feel it? Could be any of these. Time. I'm no expert on any of these. I just know that as I've been working to bring order into these spheres of my life, it is making a difference. Time. Oh, you know, some of us, we just go through life and time feels like this chaotic mess. We're overscheduled and the plates are full. I remember the first few years, even here at Nexus, I was preaching time. I never carved out time for anything. And there were days when I would, at 3 o'clock on Sunday morning, I'm still up and going, I'm gonna throw the whole thing out and start again. And just like showing up to preach going, I hope this makes sense because I'm really tired. I didn't block off enough time. And the relentless work, and I can't tell you how hard a simple thing like this was for me to do, but to say Friday I will do nothing, that is when I write my sermons and I will not meet with anyone and I'm not leaving my office until it's done. I'm carving out that time. That's how we create order. Open up space, then fill it. I think for some of us, we need that in our lives to look at our day planners and go, you know what, I gotta clear away the chaos. I gotta contain it. I think the same with money, same with thoughts. Man, how often are our thoughts like just chaos? And the amount of times we allow other people to rent space in our heads, right? Somebody says something to you and you're not quite sure if it was a compliment or insult, and for like 3 days you're like, what was that? And it's just chaos. Bring, contain the chaos. Things like cognitive behavioral therapy, prayer, these things are important for bringing order to our minds. Same in relationships. Space, you know, this summer I did a simple thing. I cleaned my office. Usually by the end of the week, there's about 30 coffee cups there. And if you ever get a takeout coffee, it starts to get moldy on the bottom. If you leave it too long, it breaks through. And yeah, that would happen in my office all the time. And I'm like, I am going to bring order to this chaos. And so I cleaned my office, set up bookshelves. And you're like, that's small. Yeah, it's small, but that's where cumulative change begins. Or a behavior, character, you look at your life and you think, I'm always grumpy in the morning, I'm always this or that. I mean, how do you look at your behavior, your character, and say, this is chaotic, so I am going to contain the chaos of my behavior and character. I'm going to make some space and then fill it with the right kind of behaviors. Man, those are small ways, but that stuff adds up. You see, how we participate in bringing order to chaos is a truly, truly remarkable thing. And I would say this, where does it begin? I think it begins this way. Speak it. Name it out loud today, this week. The fact that God brings order to chaos with the word in Genesis 1 to me is a really intriguing idea. He names things. And I mean, we see this all throughout Genesis. Things are named and they are spoken. We see this later with Adam, right? He's tasked with naming the animals. And there's almost this sense that the animals don't quite exist until they are named. It's the same thing with God in creation. All of the elements are there at the beginning, but they're not really there. They're not really formed until God speaks it. I was talking with some friends this week about the power in church community of hearing the words, you are forgiven. And we struggle with this, especially in the Protestant world, because we don't want to appear Catholic. And so very rarely do we pronounce forgiveness to other people. But there's something almost about, if it's not spoken, it's not quite real. It's still just this thought. There's a powerful archetype here, true across the board. As soon as you speak something, give it a name, its nature changes. It goes from mere thought into something concrete. So I'd say this, lay on your bed today or in a recliner, whatever it is where you're comfortable. Maybe try this, name, speak out loud what you could be if you were living into your potential. And ask Dave come and lead us in the final song, but name it out loud, not just keep it in here. I'm challenging myself on this. Name it out loud. Speak. I want more order, more peace, more shalom with my time, my money, my relationships, my space, my thoughts, my behavior, my character. What is it you could do this week right now to contain the chaos, form it, then fill it. Every single one of us here is a bundle of raw, chaotic energy potential. I don't want to tell you that this morning. If I could, I'd look you all in the eyes and say it. You are so full of potential. You, your personality, the spark that makes you the person who you are, the raw, chaotic energy inside of you is waiting to be contained and leashed and given order to. And to do that is the first step to changing your own world. To do that collectively is to do the real work of changing the world.